You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 58 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Ash.
And I'm Tilly.
And today we're continuing our deep dive into the archaeology of The Witcher.
Woohoo!
Yeah, spoilers ahead, everyone.
Very much spoilers ahead. So,
last episode we chatted about the world and landscape, but now let's turn our attention to the real treasures here, the people, the cultures, artifacts of the continent. After all, archaeology isn't just about great landscapes and monuments, right?
Exactly. And it's really fascinating to hear how, like, the humans and the elves and the dwarfs and the gnomes and, I mean, even the witches themselves all left their mark on the world somehow. So you either have, like, settlements or weapons or even the languages, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So let's explore those layers of society and material culture across the continent and see what living and dead artifacts tell us about the history and the complexity of the world we have just fought for, really, because we had the Drowners, you know, trying to kill us.
We were helping out. Although, yeah, again, if you're listening, management, no monsters were harmed in the making of this podcast episode or this archaeological survey.
We're just having a wee rest, by the way. It's fine.
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. They're fine.
You can live headless, right? That's fine.
So we've already talked a little bit about, in the last episode, about like the sort of cultures and the societies in this particular world, because that's always something, of course, that as archaeologists we're really interested in, right? We want to try and see how society was in the past. Mm-hmm. So having a bit of an understanding of how they live in the present helps, but also trying to understand like the political landscape and everything helps as well. So you mentioned that there's differences depending on what level and what species you are.
Yeah, definitely. So the different species of the world are, well, humans.
Mm-hmm. Which came late, right?
Yes, they come much later after the conjunction of the spheres.
Yeah.
I don't know where they come from, actually. I've just thought about that. But
I know, I was about to ask that. So good that you said you don't know before I asked. And don't you
let, I can't remember, no. If someone knows, let us know. But you get, you have these like overlapping civilizations that are not equal in the world because of the humans, really, and Nilfgaard and the empires and things like that. So you have the elder races, which are the elves and the dwarves, and you have witches, and you have hybrids as well. So hybrids are like dryads, so the halflings, forest dwellers, monsters, which is the pre-conjunction ones that have lived on the land, and different convergent points create hybrids and things like that, which is where the spheres have
also
sort of hit together.
To the landscape very much in terms of who lives there and everything. Okay, yeah. Which is good, because then that means if you're looking in the past or in like the history of the world for where things might have occurred in that way, then you want to look for those conjunction points as well, right? Like in terms of the landscape, like if you're wanting to find a particular site or something where hybrids may have settled or been formed or whatever, then you will look at those points in the landscape.
Yeah, and the points that bring monsters in still, I think, as well. And you see that kind of actually in I think it's the second season of the Witcher TV show. Mm-hmm. You see these kind of conjunction points, like big monoliths in that, which are like places of power. Which are kind of like quite scary to people in the land because they don't know what's going to happen with them or if the conjunction of the spheres can happen again. You know, they don't, there's like all this kind of fear around.
And
it.
These sort of big monoliths and these monuments, are they also ancient then?
Yes, I think so. But then also no, but yes.
Okay. It's very, because I always found that really interesting with like the monoliths on our world, on round world, so to speak, and how, you know, you have them around and they would have been around for like 1,000, 2,000 years. And then there's, you know, later what we would consider ancient civilizations would also have seen these massive monumental structures and were probably like, oh, you know, like, yeah, there's these big monoliths. So it's sort of, you sort of always assume that like all ancient people would know what these big monolithic monuments meant. But actually, there were some that were probably around 1,000 years after they were built. So they also maybe had no clue like what they were used for, or assigned them different meanings or something. So that would be a really interesting thing to explore, I guess, in The Witcher, is sort of discuss with locals, you know, how they perceive the monoliths and the monuments and things and how that might have changed over time.
Yeah, like I know that in the Witcher games, there's like different monoliths scattered about Vizmir, which is like a certain area in the game and in the world and the continent. So Vizmir is like the capital city of Temeria. Mm-hmm. But these aren't like naturally occurring monoliths. Again, they're like large stones and they pulse with magic, and they all have different names as well. Okay. But like initially their purpose isn't known. But then you kind of see in the games, when you zoom out more onto the map, you can actually see that they're kind of mapped out in a tree of life formation.
Okay.
So there's definitely like more influence in the games with that kind of stuff, because you sort of need that interaction in a game where you can like learn more about the surroundings, its habitants, and then you kind of have that kind of element of, you know, the mystery of the game in this area. Each area in the game has like an overall arching, I wouldn't necessarily say plot, but something around it. So there's like a location that you need to like figure out, like a mage's tower or something.
Right.
So that's more seen in the games than it is in the kind of in the books and stuff. But there are convergent points in the books which are more powerful and things like that too.
So. And do you have particular areas of the lands? So we talked about the fact that like, so you have these big monoliths, which are sort of the areas of power. You have the conjunction area, points of conjunction or something, which would be the creation of hybrids. And so if you're looking, say, you know, if you want to conduct an archaeological excavation on a particular species, are there particular places that you would look for the different species? Do they inhabit different aspects of the landscape? Is it all kind of mixed together? How's that kind of different interaction taking place?
Oh gosh, yeah, that's a huge question. But yeah,
three-part episode.
It depends, because so like different elves. I've just immediately thought of elves. Different non-human people in the game, they are in different places by either by force or by civilization. So you do sometimes have like the past civilizations of the elves. Like I think there's like a good 1,000 years in between like the conjunction of the spheres and then, you know, anyway, I might be completely wrong. You know, the TV shows expanded on this because there was a previous, like a prequel to The Witcher.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So in the prequel to The Witcher TV show, they also did another one called The Witcher Blood Origin, which was set 1,000 years before the main show, before Geralt even arrives. Okay. And that tells you of the creation of the first Witcher and then the conjunction of the spheres as well, where, you know, men and elves and everything merged together. So it kind of gives you an idea of what's gone on there. But I know that the author, Andre, didn't particularly like it. So there's like a bit of food there. So yeah, there's quite a bit of detail that you get for like different people, so the different civilizations that have come and gone. I know in the games Geralt definitely interacts with different civilizations quite often. He will speak to gnomes and dwarves and elves and everyone basically. But then you find like witches are difficult to track down unless they're at their school, like Caer Morhen, the school of the Witcher, because they're liminal outsiders, so they're transient. They live itinerant lives, you know, so they move back and forth between different landscapes. So that would be quite difficult archaeologically to sort of pinpoint. It'd be much closer to like Mesolithic hunter-gatherer kind of things. But it would be really interesting to try and find the witches and what they were doing and where they were going, because there would be certain paths. And in the games, you have a bestiary which tells you about all the different beasts. And that's kind of an idea of different witches passing down knowledge to each
other. Right, yeah. Which would then be interesting to see. I mean, and that's what you do quite a lot. I'm thinking of like in paleo Inuit studies and everything, and you'd sort of follow the path of the animals, you know, and like migratory paths and things, because that's quite often where you would also then find the human sort of hunter-gatherer groups following, you know, in that respect. So I guess you could look at patterns of beasts moving around the landscape and hope maybe you might be able to correlate that somehow with the witcher movement.
Yeah, exactly. You could. You definitely could. I think that it would just be a really fun survey to do as well.
Yeah, right. Oh no, I have to survey again for the Witcher. What the I have to just go out for a nice walk.
I don't even know their burial rites walking. As well, either witches. I don't know if they die, like they lay where they die kind of thing or not. Or if they bring them back. I can't actually think of that in the books or the games, which would be something really interesting.
That'd be really interesting.
But yeah, so you've got kind of elves, they live in the ruined cities like Sherawed and temples and things like that.
Okay.
You've got dwarves, which this is very Tolkien actually, which is the Makam mines and metalworking.
I mean, I have read very few fantasy books. actually, I can't even think of a single fantasy book or world that hasn't included dwarves in a mine somewhere.
Yeah.
Just seems to be the classic. The like, it's, yeah, that would be something really interesting to delve into.
Why?
Delve into. Oh, get it.
But even I was thinking like D&D as well, gnomes, the engineers. Like, that's the same thing in D&D. So I don't know if it's just these tropes that have sort of appeared and then you're kind of getting these stereotypes that keep going over. And like, you know, we've talked about that previous episodes, like the Cursed Child and the Chosen One and things like that.
Yeah, different tropes, Dark Lord. And I mean, which might mean that these things are up for archaeological reinterpretation. You know, maybe we're basing our interpretations of these things far too much in the assumptions that we already have about, you know, based on our knowledge of other case studies. Maybe we have to broaden our scope a little bit.
I think so. No. I think so. Yeah. No. And look into why we've sort of boxed them into certain jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Why are gnomes always engineers? Is it because they were in this particular location and therefore we assume they are in other parts of the world? Ethnographic analogy doesn't always work. So, there you go. And so that's really cool. So you can look and you can sort of see, you can see though, kind of patterns in different cultural settlement sites and that kind of thing. So you'd be able to see kind of the movement, the buildup of society and that kind of thing.
And architectural styles as well, especially in the game and then later on in the series, you get these different styles. Elves, again, there's a, you've seen this in the Rings of Power as well. They kind of have this like nouveau riche like, look about them now, which is like, the very Glasgow School of Art. Like, I don't know. It's just something about them.
What was it? I feel like it was in one of our previous episodes and someone was trying to explain these two different art styles to me. Like Art Deco.
Oh, yeah. Art Nouveau and Art
Deco. And Art Deco. Yeah. And it's like one of them is dwarves and one of them is elves. And it, but I could never remember which one's which.
I would say Art Nouveau is surely elves and Art Deco is dwarves.
I'll take your word.
Or maybe I've gone the other way around. No,
this
I'm sure it is.
This is my problem. I remember one is one, but I can't, I don't, I wouldn't be able to identify an Art Nouveau stuff.
But they do. They have these kind of like more sinuous kind of...
Inspired by nature, like different forms of nature, right? Like sort of more mm-hmm. like the leaves and the sky, whereas dwarves are then more like the earth and the stones. And
Which weirdly enough, in the Blood Origin one, they made it more, I would say there's definite like indigenous, especially South American indigenous culture, so like your earlier stuff like the Mayans, and you have that kind of influence in it, which is a really interesting
bringing in a bit of everything from the world.
I think they wanted to show an older society, so they kind of take from actual archaeological record and buildings and remains to kind of show that this is 1,000 years ago.
Kind of like the Victorians doing all the Roman style pillars and everything everywhere, because they were like Grecian columns and everything, right? And being like, look, we're like the ancient civilizations.
And you also, interestingly, with The Witcher as well, like because it's kind of that pseudo-medievalism in a way, you kind of want to have that recognizable. Well, what's the time period that's the same time period? If you go to the 1500s, who's around? Yeah. They're still the same people in the same areas making the same stuff. Well, not in the same areas, in different areas, but making different things. So you can make that more Western medieval, which is, you know, art styles and things like that. But yeah, it's interesting that there's the contrast, but they're of the same time period of that in it as well.
Yeah. And in terms of kind of, so there's a lot of the architectural, we can see in the different material culture that they have as well in that respect. But like, I think we'll get more into that afterwards. But in terms of like language, for example, so sort of inscriptions, I guess, and things like that, and how cultures build up, how they interact. Are there different languages just per species, or is like within each species, are there also different dialects and like things like that?
Well, I think there is, like, I think it's as detailed as Tolkien a lot of the time. Because, but humans use common speech, which I think is quite common actually. A lot of the times in fantasy novels, you have them speaking like common.
You're like, wow, we can understand them. Like,
you're like, oh, it's just English.
I saw like some meme the other day, which was like, I mean, really, if you're going into a different world, you know, like, surely even the language would be different in this thing. But then that means that you have to build up a whole language from scratch. And I mean, who has time for that? And someone's like, I wish to refer you to this particular author called J.R.R. Tolkien. Other people going like, yeah, but that's an anomaly. Like, you can't use him as the
base layer. The level against which to convey yourself.
It was his whole life, wasn't it? So,
right? Well, I mean, he was a professor of linguistics, right?
Exactly. So really, actually, we just need to get all the linguistic professors together and create some new languages that we can use in fantasy.
Logical reports.
Yes. That'd be so cool. Yeah, so elves, they have elder speech, which is very similar to Lord of the Rings. You've got kind of the monuments, magical text, and songs as well.
Okay.
So you've still got that influence. Dwarves and gnomes, they have technical inscriptions on tools that you find and machines and things like that too. And then you've got witcher runes. So
there are like particular scripts that you can be associated with a culture or a species.
Yeah, pretty much. And in the book, he has that as well. You know, you can kind of figure out what's going on. Yeah. But yeah, his, like Geralt's runes, he uses for magic. So he has like Ignis and stuff like that, which is a fire rune. And then they've got like spell books because witches are kind of on the cusp of like new technology and alchemical stuff. So like you've got like alchemical, your magical knowledge. So they preserve cultural memory in their schools as well. So like I said, they pass down a lot of things.
Sorry, I know I've been a bit distracted. I keep getting this little red sword emoji flashing up next to me.
Oh, yeah, that means your silver sword needs polishing.
Okay, I'm just going to do that quickly then, if that's all right, because it's super annoying. There you go, nice and shiny.
Well, that's actually a really lovely segue into the next topic of our discussion, which is material culture.
Oh, it's our element, Ash. It only took 3 sessions.
Yeah, but we did it for the build-up, right? So we could really just geek out on material culture.
We knew all our listeners were wanting to hear about the material culture of this world. Material culture. Well, I feel like things like the weapons and stuff are quite a big part, and we've already mentioned that a little bit in terms of like the witches, for example, but I guess what does that show? I mean, for example, the witches, like where do they get their swords? So we've got silver swords.
So witches have steel swords and silver swords.
That's an amazing tongue twister, by the way.
It really is. Thank you. It's not my third try or anything. But in the books, they're held differently, and in the games, they're placed on Geralt's back. Because logistically they didn't know how to do it. So it's quite funny. Sometimes you see him just chop his own head off. But they also have different things. So they have the medallions. We talked about the different witcher schools. So they're identifiable like marks that they have.
So identify their training grounds. Exactly.
So Geralt will have a wolf. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that on pretty much everything, like Tilly said in the previous episode. It's on her front cover of the book.
Yes.
It's also all over the Witcher paraphernalia. You'll see the diamond or the medallion. And that medallion actually vibrates if something is nearby.
Oh, like Sting glowing blue.
Yes, that's exactly it. So it gives Geralt, even though his senses are super keen, it'll give him a note that there's a monster nearby.
Yeah.
Which is always great when you're playing the game and then your controller starts to vibrate and you're like,
vibrate? That's so cool! Interactive gameplay. Yeah. I like as well just what you mentioned there about like that his sword was slung on his back in the game, but like differently in the other ones. Because that's something, and I was just thinking about like experimental archaeology, and there's so many times where you have an object, right, in the ground, and you sort of assume you know how it works, and then it's only as you're trying to replicate it or trying to use it in a particular activity or something that you suddenly think, huh, this doesn't work at all. Like, and then you realize, oh no, it's because I have to do it this way or I have to do it that way. And that's why I love working with chatting with reenactors and people who are involved in living history, because they're actually like testing out these things, basically, like trying to work out, okay, but yeah, sure, they have this sword, but how would he have carried it? Like, would he have carried it this way? And I always find it so fascinating to see those kind of, they are experiments in a way. I mean, they may not have like a super incredibly scientific hypothesis, but you know, the research question they're asking is, how would you have worn a sword, you know, sort of thing.
Yes. And I always find that this is the thing. I love it. And when you see like historical, like period dramas, which are never like as accurate as they should be, or you know, it's kind of drama is more of the important bit, but then you see like archers and stuff like that going like, that would never work.
Exactly. Yeah, you have all these ones on YouTube like a professional swordsman reviews, you know, or whatever, and it's like, that wouldn't happen.
No. And I think the devs of the game were like trying to figure out how to get Geralt to do it. I think what they do is like he actually reaches over with the opposite hand to grab whichever sword is like on the opposite side of his back.
That makes sense, yeah.
So it gives him more of an extension because they're really long swords as well. They are long swords.
God, yeah. So trying to get them out of you.
Yeah, you'd be stuck and you'd be like, oh, like, God. So yeah, I think he reaches over and has like, and I did play the game just before we did this. So
oh, excellent. Wonderful getting in the spirit of the game. Yeah, perfect.
But sometimes he does chop his own head off, which is quite funny. But he doesn't, the game just continues on. It glitches slightly as you're trying to get it out of its holster. But so you kind of have on the continent of the material culture on the continent, again, like most things that you see in The Witcher, it's sort of integrated by human interaction. So you kind of have, you've got your elves, they create quite elegant nature integrated structures and magical artifacts and things like that.
So humans, the typology in that respect a little.
So they have like kind of more silver inlaid ceremonial stuff. So you can imagine if you've seen Lord the Rings, if you've read Lord of the Rings, you can kind of imagine what like Sting would look like. So it's the same sort of stuff. They
did
also
you
have
say ceremonial, by the way.
No, but I didn't say the other word. I didn't say the other word.
Ritual. I also love. I have no idea why it does it twice every time.
I know. I'm very excited.
Anyway, sorry. Carry on.
But then humans, actually, one of the huge things in the game and in the series is actually their religion. And the different areas. So I can't exactly remember if this is in the books, but in the game, Temerians or Redanians, depends on which way you go, because there's a whole conflict, they are in red. Nilfgaard, though, this is definitely in the books, Nilfgaard have black armor. So you always know it's a Nilfgaard person because they're wearing black. And it's and it's quite like detailed big armor, And they also have eternal fire. So that's the one of the kind of more rampant religions in the books and in the games that kind of dislike hybrids, dislike non-humans. Mm-hmm. And it's easily recognizable. It's just a big fire.
Right.
So you know exactly where that's come from. They have more like domestic pottery. So I imagine it as like you kind of gritty wear stuff.
Okay. Functional. Doesn't have to be pretty.
No, humans are like, if they had to be like a color in, like if elves are green, right?
Yeah.
Humans are beige.
Right.
So, you got your dwarves and gnomes are like your gray, you've got your mines and your underground architecture, your tools, your forged axes and crossbows and mechanisms and durable stuff.
Heavy duty, high quality, lasts a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you do have some other like carvings, more natural stuff that people are putting into the landscape. Usually that's your kind of dryads and things.
And would it be, because it's sort of a medieval-esque world, is it that like that you still have sort of workshops so you can still see sort of more, it's specialized, but it's not to the stage of like factory production, for example, or like mass production in the material culture?
That's like a really good question. It depends, I think, where you are in the cities and stuff like that. It tends to be more, it's not capitalist or anything like that, but there are more markets and there's things like that where you kind of have more of an urban center that's sort of producing. Maybe so you would have more blacksmiths and
quality or something.
Yeah, exactly. So you do have kind of mass produced swords, especially in and stuff like that. So in Novigrad and centers like that, where there's these kind of markets that people are going to all the time.
Yeah.
You see that kind of coming out. But then you see sort of there's a distinction between the northern area and Nilfgaard in material. So in the north, it's very medieval, rustic, handcrafted. But then in Nilfgaard, you have like imperial, it's uniformed, it's engineered, it's standardized. So archaeologically, you kind of see these like traces of density and scale, so you kind of see them,
which fits with the culture as well little bit, right? Like if you have that standardization, that kind of shows like they don't want people to be diverse or to have their own views. They have, everyone has to conform and that kind of thing. So
that's exactly it. While when you've got looking at like elven material culture in it, you have, it's ancient and elegant, but it's decaying, and it's kind of a marker of that lost golden age that is no longer going on, but it's very harmonized with that natural environment. So you have the curved lines, you have integrated with trees and waters, it's yeah. light, it's magical. The jewelry and clothing often have organic motifs, so leaves and starlight and moonlight and metals, and rather than anything else. So you do really see that distinct divide. And I think that's why it's done so well as a series, to be able to put it into books and games.
Yeah.
There's something that's so easy about it to identify by the human eye. You can see that different culture in the material culture really easily.
Yeah. Which again, because it has that deep history to yeah. it, and it has that, you can tell that story. Like, it's not just shallow, it's got that deepness to it, which is why we can do an archaeological dive into it, which is yes. exciting. But yeah, and there's also then the sort of, so we talked about like the cities a little bit, about the artifacts and all that kind of thing. Because, I mean, you have the material culture, but I mean, for example, a lot of the monsters, like, I can't remember in the books, but I remember in the series, you had, for example, an episode with like a dragon, and then the dragon egg, and people saw the dragon egg as the treasure, but then it was actually an egg that would hatch out and all of that kind of thing. And you had like the djinn, which was in the, whatever it was, a pot of some sort. And mm-hmm. then it was also a djinn. So, I mean, that's something that we've dealt with a little bit in previous episodes. Like, what is actually material culture in these fantasy worlds? Can you count these sort of monsters and these magical beings as an artifact?
Well, yeah, exactly. Because they kind of are, in a way, yeah. because they are seen, a lot of the older monsters especially, they're sort of, you know, the remains of yeah. a pre-conjunction time, so yeah. they could be considered as a biological artifact because they live yeah. for so long, unless, you know, Geralt comes along and
ugh, but witches. Yeah.
You're becoming very Nilfgaardian there. That's witches. Very Nilfgaardian.
Oh no, I'm not a Nilfgaardian, I swear.
How empire of you.
Oh man. It's all good, man. It's all chill. I'm fine. I'm just a Marian, man. But yeah.
Well, no. Actually, that's a good segue though, because you, in a way, what you've just displayed is that cultural hybridity and yeah. interaction that you see in the books. So you kind of have that, these kind of urban centers like Novigrad and Oxenfurt, where they serve as those contact zones. Yeah. So you kind of get where ideas, people, material culture, they collide, and prejudice collides as well. And you right. sort of kind of, it sort of mirrors a real world cultural layering, which you find in lots of archaeology. You know, we see lots of shared architecture, trade, yes. festivals, languages. You also kind of get the human, I say human, non-human myth, and religions absorbing into new ones, the kind yeah. of symbiotic way that culture moves. So you kind of have that. And then you've also got the rebellion of it all. So there is a whole rebellion in The Witcher, which you see actually in the TV show, if you're familiar with it, which is the Scott Tal Rebellion. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how you say it.
I mean, I'm just smiling and nodding.
But that's actually a reaction against forced assimilation, which is interesting.
Yeah, which is really fascinating. And that's always something I find interesting when you talk to people and they're like, oh yes, I love the Celts. And you're like, okay, who? What is a Celt? Describe a Celt yeah, to me, exactly. You know? Or like, or you say like, oh, I love an ancient Roman. They were a Roman, you know? And it's like, okay, but what is a Roman?
What
like,
is a Roman?
You know, like you have people who are living in ancient Rome, but then you also have inhabitants of the Roman Empire. And like, there's so much variation in modern culture, which I mean, I'm not going to get on my soapbox and rant about the ridiculousness of nationalism and borders and national
oh, yes.
identity.
Please do.
Oh God, don't get me started. Honestly, I'm applying for my permanent resident permit at the moment and it's ridiculous. But anyway, but it's that whole thing, right? And that's how a lot of issues occur. And quite often archaeology and history and these things are used for those particular agendas. And I know I've mentioned this a couple of times in these episodes, and it might be because I've been teaching about this topic recently, so it's quite forefront in my mind. But I think especially in these days, that's why I feel like archaeology is really important. And the fact that we can even show that in this fantastical world that happens, you know, and show that's the reasoning for it, and, you know, that you can approach it from an archaeological perspective and demonstrate why certain political views are problematic. And in a fantasy world, it's like, oh yeah, well of course, yeah, then they're evil and this is that and this is that, but then it happens in the real world as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very current topic at the moment and something that archaeology should be used to expose and to see and to look, because yeah. you're right, there's a lot of it's such a complex issue
yeah.
with civilization and archaeology. But archaeology does show you, like, I remember, right, this is such a side note, but I remember I used to do tours around Glasgow, and I would take people to certain areas, and there's the one called the Lady Well. There's lots of mm-hmm. Lady Wells all over Scotland.
Okay.
And archaeologically, we know that they are much earlier than when the Romans came and recognized these certain areas, especially in the lower, like the central belt. Mm-hmm. So we know that this is a site that has been used as a water site. We know it's been used in pre-Christian times, dedicated likely to a female goddess of some kind, because it's called Lady Well, because when Christian ideas came in, they repurposed them into founts to Mary, right? So that's why they're called Lady Wells.
Yeah.
And I remember getting, a lady came up to me, and she was very angry about me saying this, that actually it's a very symbiotic relationship. Yes, it is. And you also find this kind of cultural suppression in a lot of ways around religion and things like that. But she was very angry that I would ever even say that, because no, these were definitely Christian monuments. And I was like, they are, but there's also
they're not.
They're not. And there's a reason why, because you have this kind of wave of colonial, I suppose, even mm-hmm. pre-colonial stuff coming in from Rome. You know, a lot of people don't even quite see that, which
the nuance of it, and like
exactly.
it's complex. It's there's no black and white to history or prehistory or
You know, there's so much that the people borrow from each other, and you see that in fantasy so well. They do it so well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that people are more open to chatting about it in terms of fantasy universes than they are in the real world.
Yeah, but there's something less threatening. And I think that's something that's really important about reading and books in general, is that it gives you that safe space to explore these complex ideas. And I think when you find stuff like The Witcher or even Tolkien or, you know, anything, it sort of reflects the world's social complexity. Yeah. And so you kind of have... One, you have the view of history in a fantasy setting. You also, too, have the view of this history in, for example, in The Witcher, with Sapkowski's own idea of what history is.
Yes,
so
right. And his idea experience of that. Yeah.
Yeah. His idea is really no civilization fully replaces the other. It sort of builds over it.
Yeah.
But then you also have the complex idea of actually dominating what was the dominant idea of history and how, what are the voices underneath that and your own interpretation.
Yes.
So yeah, very cool. Like the material culture in Witcher really does reflect like identity, memory, and definitely decline. And that's something that we see in archaeology all the time.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, so we're kind of running to the end of this episode now, but this is something Ash and I had this idea for doing this episode. And then there's another one coming up in the new year, which I'm very excited for. Guess what the topic will be. And we really loved prepping to these episodes and thinking about them and having these as kind of thought experiments. So we'd be really interested to hear from you, the listeners, whether you've enjoyed this. So sort of rather than focusing on a fantasy kind of concept, actually doing a deep dive into like a particular fantasy universe or a book or a fantasy world or, you know, something like that, and covering all of these different aspects of it in a lot more detail. So we'd have, sort of multiple episodes dedicated to a single book or a single universe. So if that's something you've enjoyed, if that's something you want to hear more about, let us know.
Please do.
Yeah, we'd really love to hear it. But yeah.
Well, I think our preliminary archaeological survey of the continent is complete.
Yes.
Yeah. We've slayed monsters, unearthed ruins, and traced the layer of human, non-human, and hybrid societies.
And along the way, we've also seen how material culture, so all of the things that we just discussed, really tell the story of who lived there and how they interacted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's about it for this episode of Am I Trowel. We hope you enjoyed our big quest. to conquer the continent of The Witcher. As always, please do like, subscribe, follow us wherever you get your podcasts, because it really does help support the show. And join us on our Discord as well. It is free, and we'd love to hear all your thoughts about these episodes. If you're interested in hearing more archaeological content, make sure to check out the other shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network. You'll find all contact info, plus links and further reading on today's discussion in our show notes.
Yes. And also, just a very quick note to say, the Archaeology Podcast Network will be having a short break over the holiday period into the new year. So we're going to skip a couple of episodes and you'll be hearing back from us at the end of January next year. So happy new year, everyone, and see you then.
Bye.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.